to Augustus. Custer didn't see him either, Augustus pointed out. Not till he was caught. Now that we're here, do you plan to stop, or will we just keep going north till we get into the polar bears? I plan to stop, but not yet, Carl said. We ain't crossed the Yellowstone. I like the thought of having the first ranch north of the Yellowstone. But you ain't a rancher, Augustus said. I guess I am now. No, you're a fighter. We should have left these damn cows down in Texas. You use them as an excuse to come up here when you ain't interested in them and didn't need an excuse anyway. I think we ought to just give them to the Indians when the Indians show up. Give the Indians 3,000 cattle, Carl said, amazed at the notions his friend had. Why do that? Because then we'd be shut of them. We could follow our noses for a change instead of following their asses. Ain't you bored? I don't think like you do, Carl said. They're ours. We got them. I don't plan on giving them to anybody. I miss Texas, and I miss whiskey, Augustus said. Now here we are in Montana, and there's no telling what will become of us. Miles City's up here somewhere, Carl said. You can buy whiskey. Yes, but I have to drink it indoors, Augustus complained. It's cool up here. As if to confirm his remark, the very next day an early storm blew out of the Bighorns. An icy wind came up and snow fell in the night. The men on the night herd wrapped blankets around themselves to keep warm. A thin snow covered the plains in the morning, to the amazement of everyone. The Spittle boy was so astonished to wake and see it that he refused to come out of his blankets at first, afraid of what might happen. He lay wide-eyed, looking at the whiteness. Only when he saw the other hands tramping in it without ill effect did he get up. Newt had been curious about snow all the way north, but he had lost his jacket somewhere in Kansas, and now that snow had actually fallen, he felt too cold to enjoy it. All he wanted to do was be warm again. He had taken his boots off when he lay down to sleep, and the snow had melted on his feet, getting his socks wet. His boots were a tight fit, and it was almost impossible to get them on over wet socks. He went over to the fire barefoot, hoping to dry his socks, but so many of the cowboys were huddled around the fire that he couldn't get a place at first. P.I. had scooped up a handful of snow and was eating it. The Rainy boys had made snowballs, but all the cowboys were stiff and cold and looked threatening, so the Rainy boys merely threw the snowballs at one another. This snow tastes like hail, except that it's soft, P.I. observed. The sun came out just then and shone so brightly on the white plains that some of the men had to shield their eyes. Newt finally got a place by the fire, but by then the captain was anxious to move on and he didn't try to dry his socks. He tried to pull his boots on, but had no luck until Pocampo noticed his difficulty and came over with a little flour, which he sprinkled in the boots. This will help, he said. And he was right, though getting the boots on still wasn't easy. The sun soon melted the thin snow, and for the next week the days were hot again. Pocampo walked all day behind the wagon, followed by the pigs, who bored through the tall grass like moles. A sight that amused the cowboys, although Augustus worried that the pigs might stray off.
We ought to let them ride in the wagon, he suggested to Carl.
I don't see why.
Well, they made history, Augustus pointed out.
When? Carl asked. I didn't notice.
Why, they're the first pigs to walk all the way from Texas to Montana. That's quite a feat for a pig.
What will it get them? Carl inquired. Eaten by a bear if they ain't careful, or eaten by us if they are. They've had a long walk for nothing.
Yes, and the same's likely true for us, Augustus said, irritated that his friend wasn't more appreciative of pigs.
With Dietz dead, Augustus and Carl alternated the scouting duties. One day, Augustus asked Newt to ride along with him, much to Newt's surprise.
In the morning, they saw a grizzly, but the bear was far upwind and didn't scent them. It was a beautiful day, no clouds in the sky. Augustus rode with his big rifle propped across the saddle. He was in the highest of spirits. They rode ahead of the herd some 15 miles or more, and yet when they stopped to look back, they could still see the cattle, tiny black dots in the middle of the plain, with the southern horizon still far behind them.
"I never thought to see so far," Newt said.
"Ain't it something?" Augustus said with a grin. "This is rare country, this Montana. We're a lucky bunch. There ain't nothing better than this. Though you don't have to tell your pa I said it."
Newt had decided it must be one of Mr. Gus's many jokes, making out that the captain was his pa.
"I like to keep Woodrow feeling that he's caused a peck of trouble. I don't want him to get sassy, but I wouldn't have missed coming up here. I can't think of nothing better than riding a fine horse into a new country. It's exactly what I was meant for, and Woodrow, too."
"Do you think we'll see Indians?" Newt asked.
"You bet. We might all get killed this afternoon, for all I know. That's the wild for you. It's got its dangers, which is part of the beauty. Of course, the Indians have had this land forever. To them, it's precious because it's old. To us, it's exciting because it's new."
Newt noticed that Mr. Gus had a keen look in his eye. His white hair was long, almost to his shoulders. There seemed to be no one who could enjoy himself like Mr. Gus.
"Now there's women, of course. I do cotton to 'em, but I ain't found one yet who could hold me back from a chance like this. Women are persistent creatures, and will try to nail you down. But if you just dance on off, you'll usually find 'em close to the spot where you left 'em. Most of 'em."
"Do you really know who my pa is?" Newt asked. Mr. Gus was being so friendly, he felt he could ask.
"Old Woodrow Call is your pa, son," Augustus said, as if it were a matter of casual knowledge.
For the first time, Newt felt it might be true, although extremely puzzling.
"Well, he never mentioned it," he pointed out.
Just being told such news didn't settle much. In fact, it just made new problems, for if the captain was his father, then why hadn't he mentioned it?
"It's a subtle problem," Augustus said.
Newt didn't find that a helpful answer, mainly because he didn't know what subtle meant.
"Looks like he'd mention it," he said softly.
He didn't want to criticize the captain, especially not to Mr. Gus, the only man who did criticize the captain.
"It wouldn't be his way to mention it. Woodrow don't mention nothing that he can keep from mentioning. You couldn't call him a mentioner."
Newt found it very puzzling. If the captain was his father, then he must have known his mother. But he had never mentioned that either. He could remember times when he had daydreamed that the captain was his father and would take him on long trips. Now, in a way, the daydream had come true. The captain had taken him on a long trip. But instead of feeling proud and happy, he felt let down and confused. If it was true, why had everybody been such a long time mentioning it? Dietz had never mentioned it. P.I. had never mentioned it. Worst of all, his mother had never mentioned it. He had been young when she died, but not too young to remember something so important. He could still remember some of the songs that she had sung to him. He could have remembered who his father was. It didn't make sense. And he rode beside Mr. Gus for several miles, puzzling about it silently.
"Did you ask me to come along to tell me?" Newt asked finally. "Yep," Augustus admitted.
Newt knew he ought to thank him, but he didn't feel in the mood to thank anybody. The information just seemed to make his whole life more puzzling. It spoiled every good thing he had felt for most of his life, not only about his mother, but about the captain and about the Hat Creek outfit as a whole.
"I know it's tardy news," Augustus said. "Since Woodrow ain't a mentioner, I thought I'd tell you. You never know what might happen."
Chapter 94.
"I wish I'd known sooner,"
Newt said. It was the one thing he was sure of. Yes, I expect you do. I ought to have discussed it sooner, but it was really Woodrow's place to tell you, and I kept hoping he'd do it, though I knew he wouldn't. Is it that he don't like me? Newt asked. He felt the longing to be back in Texas. The news coming when it did had spoiled Montana. No, Augusta said. What you have to understand is that Woodrow Call is a peculiar man. He likes to think that things are a certain way. He likes to think everybody does their duty, especially him. He likes to think people live for duty. I don't know what started him thinking that way. He ain't dumb. He knows perfectly well that people don't live for duty. But he won't admit it about anybody if he can help it. And he especially won't admit it about himself. Newt saw that Mr. Gus was laboring to explain it to him. But it was no good. So far as he could tell, the captain did live for duty. What did that have to do with the captain being his father? Woodrow don't like to admit that he's like the rest of us, Augusta said, seeing the boy's perplexity. He ain't, Newt said. That was obvious. The captain never behaved like other people. He ain't, that's true. But he had a chance to be once, and he turned his back on it. And now he ain't about to admit that he made the wrong choice. He'd as soon kill himself. He's got to keep trying to be the way that he thinks he is. And he's got to make out that he was always that way. It's why he ain't owned up to being your pa. Soon they turned and headed back toward the herd. It's funny. I knew my pa. He was a gentleman. He didn't do much but raise horses and hounds and drink whiskey. He never hit me a lick in my life, nor even raised his voice to me. He drank whiskey every night and disappointed my mother. But both my sisters doted on him like he was the only man. In fact, one of them's an old maid to this day because she doted on Dad. But Dad never interested me. I let out from that place when I was 13 years old. I ain't stopped yet. I didn't care one way or the other for Dad. I just seen that horses and hounds would get boring if you tried to make them alive. I expect I'd have wrecked every marriage in that county if I'd stayed in Tennessee, or else have got killed in a duel. Newt knew Mr. Gus was trying to be kind, but he wasn't listening. Much of his life he had wondered who his father was and where he might be. He felt it would be a relief to know, but now he knew, and it wasn't a relief. There was something in it that thrilled him. He was Captain Call's son, but more that felt sad. He was glad when Mr. Gus put the horses in a lope. He didn't have to think as much. They loped over the grassy plains toward the cattle in the far distance. The cattle looked tiny as ants. The men began to talk of the Yellowstone River as if it were a place where the world ended, or at least the place where the drive would end. In their thinking, it had taken on a magical quality, partly because no one really knew anything about it. Jasper Fant had somehow picked up the rumor that the Yellowstone was the size of the Mississippi and as deep. All the way north, everyone had been trying to convince Jasper that it didn't really make any difference how deep a river was once it got deep enough to swim a horse, but Jasper felt the argument violated common sense. The deeper the river, the more dangerous. That was axiomatic to him. He had heard about something called undercurrents, which could suck you down. The deeper the river, the farther down you could be sucked, and Jasper had a profound fear of being sucked down. Particularly, he didn't want to be sucked down in the Yellowstone. He had made himself a pair of rude floats from some empty lard buckets, just in case the Yellowstone really did turn out to be as deep as the Mississippi. I didn't come all this way just to drown in the last darn river, Jasper said. It ain't the last, Augusta said. Montana don't stop at the Yellowstone. The Missouri is up there somewhere, and it's a whale of a river. Well, I don't aim to cross it, Jasper said. It seemed to him that he had spent half the trip imagining how it would be to be sucked down into a deep river. He wanted it understood that he was only willing to take so many chances. I guess you'll cross it if the captain wants to keep going, Dish said. Jasper's river fears grated on everybody's nerves. Nobody liked crossing rivers, but it didn't help to talk about the dangers constantly for 3,000 miles.
Well, Jake talked of the Milk River and one called Amarius, Augusta said.
Looks like you'd be satisfied, Jasper said. Ain't we traveled enough? I'd like to step into a saloon in good old Fort Worth myself. I'd like to see my home again while my folks are still alive.
Why, that ain't the plan. We're up here to start a ranch. Home and hearth don't interest us. We hired you men for life. You ought to have said goodbye to the old folks before you left.
What are we going to do now that we're here? Lippy asked. The question was on everyone's mind. Usually when the cattle drive ended, the men just turned around and went back to Texas. But then most drives stopped in Kansas, which seemed close to home compared to where they were now. Many of them harbored secret doubts about their ability to navigate a successful return to Texas. Of course, they knew the direction, but they would have to make the trip in winter, and the Indians that hadn't been troublesome on the way north might want to fight as they went south.
I like a town, Lippy added. It don't have to be St. Louis, just a town. As long as it has a saloon or two, I can get by. But I wasn't meant to live out in the open during the winter.
Call knew the men were wondering, but he wasn't ready to stop. Jake had said some of the most beautiful land was far to the north, near Canada. It would be a pity to stop and make a choice before they had looked around thoroughly. He contemplated leaving the men and going on a look around himself, north of the Yellowstone, but decided against it, mainly because of Indians. Things looked peaceful, but that didn't mean they would stay peaceful. There could easily be a bad fight, and he didn't want to be gone if one came. Finally, he decided to send Augustus.
I hate to give you the first look, but somebody's got to look, he said.
Would you want to go?
Oh, sure, Augusta said. I'd be happy to get away from all this tedious conversation. Maybe I'll trot through this Miles City community and see if anyone stocks champagne.
Take the look around first, if you can be bothered, Carl said. I doubt the main street of Miles City would make a good ranch, and I doubt you'll get any further once you spot a saloon. We need to find a place and get some shelters built before winter hits. Take a man with you, in case you get into trouble.
I can get myself out of trouble, but if I have to lead some quaking spirit like Jasper Fant, it'll slow me down. None of these cowpokes is exactly wilderness hands. We buried the last reliable man down on the Powder, remember?
I remember, Carl said.
You don't want to make too many mistakes in this part of the country. You'll end up bear shit.
Take P, Carl said. P can follow orders.
Yes, that's what he can do, Augusta said. I guess I'll take him, though he won't provide much conversation.
P.I. was not enthusiastic about going on a scout with Gus, but since the captain told him to, he tied his bedroll on his saddle and got ready. Other than securing his bedroll, his preparations consisted mainly of sharpening his knife. One thing P.I. firmly believed was that it was foolish to start on a trip without a sharp knife. Inevitably, on a trip, there were things that needed cutting or skinning or trimming. Once his knife was sharp, P.I. was ready, more or less. He knew he wouldn't get much relaxation on the trip because he was traveling with Gus, and Gus talked all the time. It was hard to relax when he had to be constantly listening. Besides, Gus was always asking questions which were hard to understand, much less answer. It was a breezy morning when they started out. A dark cloud bank had formed in the northwest, and the men were talking of snow.
I said way back in Lonesome Dove we'd be crossing the dern Yellowstone on ice if we didn't get started, Jasper reminded them. Now all this time has passed, and I may be right. Even if you was right, you'd be wrong, Jasper, Augusta said as he stuffed an extra box or two of ammunition in the saddlebags.
I'd like to know why, Gus, Jasper said, annoyed that Gus was always singling him out for criticism.
I'll explain it when I get back, Augusta said. Come on, P. Let's go see if we can find Canada.
They loped off, watched by the whole camp. The crew had been made melancholy by the approaching clouds. Pocampo had wandered off looking for roots. Augustus and P.I. passed him nearly a mile from camp.
Poe, you're a rambler, Augustus said. What do you expect to find on this old plain?
Wild onions, Pocampo said. I'd like an onion.
I'd like a jug of bourbon whiskey myself, Augusta said. I wonder which one of us will get his wish.
Adios, Pocampo said. A day and a half later, the two scouts rode over a grassy bluff and saw the Yellowstone River a few miles away. 50 or 60 buffalo were watering when they rode up. At the sight of the horsemen, a buffalo scattered. A cloud bank had blown away, and the blue sky was clear for as far as one could see. The river was swift but not deep. Augustus paused in his crossing and leaned down, drinking from his cupped hands. The water was cold.
Sweet water, but it don't compare with bourbon whiskey, he said.
Jasper won't need them floats, P.I. remarked.
He might, Augustus said. He might fall off his horse if he gets real nervous. Let's chase the buffalo for a while.
Why? P. asked. Pocampo had packed them plenty of meat. He couldn't imagine why Gus would bother with buffalo. They were cumbersome to skin, and he and Gus had no need for so much meat. Nonetheless, it was follow or be left, for Augustus had loped off after the buffalo, who had only run about a mile. He soon put them into flight again and raced along beside them, riding close to the herd. P.I., caught by surprise, was left far behind in the race. He kept expecting to hear Gus's big rifle, but he didn't, and after a run of about 2 miles, came upon Gus sitting peacefully on a little rise. The buffalo were still running, 2 or 3 miles ahead.
"Kill any?" P.I. asked. "No, I wasn't hunting," Augusta said.
"Did you just want to run 'em off, or what?" P. asked. As usual, Gus's behavior was a complete puzzle.
"P., you ain't got your grip on the point. I just wanted to chase a buffalo once more. I won't have the chance much longer, and nobody else will either, because there won't be no buffalo to chase. And it's a grand sport, too."
"Them bulls can hook you," P.I. reminded him. "Remember old Barlow? A buffalo bull hooked his horse, and the horse fell on Barlow and broke his hip."
"Barlow was a slow thinker," Augustus observed. "He just loped along and got hooked."
"A slow walker, too, once his hip got broke. I wonder what happened to Barlow."
"I think he migrated to Seguin, or somewhere over there," Augustus said. "Married a fat widow and had a passel offspring. You ought to have done the same, but here you are in Montana."
"Well, I'd hate not to be a bachelor," P.I. said.
"Just because it's all you know don't mean it's all you'd enjoy. You had a chance at a fine widow right there, Lonesome Dove, as I recall."
P.I. was sorry the subject of widows had come up. He had nearly forgotten the Widow Cole and the day he had helped her take the washing off the line. He didn't know why he hadn't forgotten it completely. He surely had forgotten more important things. Yet there it was, and from time to time it shoved into his brain. If he had married some widow, his brain would probably have been so full of such things that he would have no time to think, or even keep his knife sharp.
"Ever meet any of the mountain men?" Augustus asked. "They got up in here and took the beavers."
"Well, I met old Kit. You ought to remember. You was there."
"Yes, I remember," Augustus said. "I never thought much of Kit Carson."
"Why? What was wrong with Kit Carson? They say he could track anything."
Kit was vain. I won't tolerate vanity in a man, though I will in a woman. If I had gone north in my youth, I might have got to be a mountain man. But I took to river boating instead. The whores on them river boats in my day barely wore enough clothes to pad a crutch. As they rode north, they saw more buffalo, mostly small bunches of 20 or 30. The third day north of the Yellowstone, they killed a crippled buffalo calf and dined on its liver. In the morning when they left, there was a number of buzzards and two or three prairie wolves hanging around waiting for them to leave the carcass. It was a beautiful morning, crisp for an hour or two, and then sunny and warm. The country rolled on to the north, as it had for thousands of miles, brown in the distance, the prairie grass waving in the breeze.
"Lord, how much land does the captain want?" P.I. asked. "Looks like this country around here would be good enough for anybody. Plenty would settle for it. You're right," Augusta said. "Carl might himself. But let's go on for a day or two more. We ain't struck the Milk River yet."
"Does it run milk?" P.I. asked.
"Now think a minute, P. How could it run milk when there ain't no cows up here yet?"
"Why did they call it the Milk, then? Milk is milk."
"Crazy is crazy, too," Augusta said. "That's what I'll be before long listening to you. Crazy."
"Well, Jasper's mind might break if he don't stop worrying about them rivers," P.I. allowed. "I expect the rest of us will keep our wits." Augustus laughed heartily at the notion of the Hat Creek outfit keeping its wits.
"It's true that they could be kept in a thimble," he said. "But who brought a thimble?"
There was a little rise to the west, and Augustus loped over to it to see what the land looked like in that direction. P trotted along north, as he had been doing, not paying much attention. Gus was always loping off to test the view, as he called it, and P didn't feel obliged to follow him every time. Then P heard the sound of a running horse and looked for Gus, supposing he had jumped another little bunch of buffalo. What he saw froze him instantly in place. Gus was racing down the little slope he had just gone up, with at least 20 mounted Indians hot on his heels. He must have ridden right into them. The Indians were shooting both guns and arrows. A bullet cut the grass ahead of P, and he yanked out his rifle and popped a shot back at the Indians before whirling his horse and fleeing. Gus and he had crossed a good-sized creek less than an hour back, with some trees along it and some weeds and shrubbery in the creek bed. He assumed Gus might be racing for that, since it was the only shelter on the wide prairie. Even as he started, P saw five or six Indians veer toward him. He swerved over to join Gus, who had two arrows in his leg. Gus was flailing his horse with his rifle barrel, and the horse was running full out. Fortunately, the Indians were poorly mounted. Their horses were no match for the Hat Creek horses, and the two men soon widened the gap between them and their pursuers. They were out of range of arrows and of bullets, too, P hoped, but he had hardly hoped it when a bullet stung him just above the shoulder blade. But the creek was only 3 or 4 miles ahead. If they could make it, there would be time enough to worry about wounds. Gus was trying to pull the arrows out of his leg as he rode, but he was having no luck. They saw the curve of the little creek from 2 miles away and angled for the nearest juncture. The Indians had fallen nearly a quarter of a mile back, but were still coming. When they struck the creek, Augustus raced along the bank until he found a spot where the weeds and brush were thickest. Then he jumped his horse off the bank and grabbed his saddlebags.
"Get all the ammunition you can," he said. "We're in for a shooting match, and tie the horses in the best cover you can find, or they'll shoot 'em. This is long country to be afoot in."
Then he hobbled to the bank, wishing he had had time to cut the two arrows out of his leg. But if they were poisoned, it was already too late. And if he didn't do some fine shooting, it wouldn't matter anyway, because the Indians would overrun them. P heard the big Henry rifle begin to roar as he dragged the sweating horses into the thickest part of the underbrush. It was thick but low, and he didn't think there was much chance for the horses. He yanked the saddlebags and bedrolls off both horses and was hiding them under the bank when Gus stopped firing for a moment.
"Get my saddle," he said. I'll show you a trick.
Then he began to fire again. Evidently, he had turned the Indians, or they would already have been in the creek bed. P dutifully got the saddle. When he got back, Gus was reloading. P peeped over the bank and saw the Indians, stopped some distance away. Many of them had dismounted and were standing behind their horses, using them as shields.
How many did you kill? He asked.
Not but three, Augusta said. This is a smart bunch we're up against. They seen right off a rush had cost them dear.
P.I. watched the Indians for a while. They weren't yelling, and they didn't seem excited.
I don't see what's so smart about them, he said. They're just standing there.
Yes, but they're out of range, Augusta said. They're hoping to tempt me to waste ammunition.
Augustus propped the saddle on the bank in such a way that he could shoot under it and be that much safer if the Indians shot back. He then proceeded to shoot six times rapidly. Five of the Indians' horses dropped. The sixth ran squealing over the prairie. It fell several hundred yards away. The Indians fired several shots in reply, their bullets slicing harmlessly into the underbrush. The party of Indians then split. Several Indians went north of them, several south, and eight or ten stayed where they were.
Well, we're practically surrounded, Augusta said. I don't expect we'll hear any more from them till dark.
I'd hate to wait around here till dark, P.I. said.
Did you know your shot?
Augustus asked. P. had forgotten it. Sure enough, the front of his shirt was soaked with blood. He took it off, and Augustus examined the wound, which was clean. The bullet had gone right through. They turned their attention to the arrows in Augustus's left leg. Augustus twisted at them whenever he got a moment. One arrow he soon got out, but the other wouldn't budge.
Oh, this one's deep, he said. That brave wasn't more than 20 yards away when he let fly. I think it's worked under the bone, but it ain't poisoned. If it was, I'd be feeling it by now.
P had a try at removing the arrow, while Gus gritted his teeth and held his leg steady with both hands. The arrow wouldn't budge. It wouldn't even turn, though P.I. twisted hard enough to cause a stream of blood to flow down Gus's leg. As they were working with the arrow, there was a sudden terrified squeal from the horses. Augustus hobbled over, drawing his pistol, and saw that both horses were down, their throats cut, their blood very bright on the green weeds and bushes.
"Stay back, P.," he said, crouching.
The Indian that had killed the horses was there somewhere, in the underbrush, but he couldn't see him.
"Watch to the north, P.," he said. "I don't think these boys want to stay around here till dark, either."
He quickly wiped the sweat from his forehead, keeping a bush directly in front of him, and he edged very slowly to the bank, just high enough that he could see the tops of the weeds and underbrush. Then he waited. Once the dying horses finally stopped thrashing, it was very still. Augustus regretted that his preoccupation with the arrows had made him so lax that he had failed to protect the horses. It put them in a ticklish spot. It was over 100 miles back to the Yellowstone, and in all likelihood the herd hadn't even gotten there yet. He kept his eyes focused on the tops of the underbrush. It was perfectly windless in the creek bottom, and if the underbrush moved, it would be because someone moved it. His big pistol was cocked. He didn't move, and time stretched out. Minutes passed. Augustus carefully kept the sweat wiped out of his eyes, concentrating on keeping his focus. The silence seemed to ring, it was so absolute. There were no flies buzzing yet, no birds flying, nothing. He would have bet the Indian was not 20 yards away from him, and yet he had no inkling of precisely where he was.
"Ain't you coming back, Gus?"
P.I. asked after several minutes. Augustus didn't answer. He watched the tops of the weeds patiently. It was no time for hurry, much less for conversation. Patience was an Indian virtue. He himself didn't have it in day-to-day life, but he could summon it when it seemed essential. Then he heard a movement behind him and glanced around quickly to see P had suddenly decided to take a stroll. When he did, he saw the edge of a rifle extending an inch or two from the weeds.
pointed not at himself but at P. He immediately fired twice into the weeds, and an Indian flopped over as a fish might flop. A second later, as the echo of the gun died, he heard a click a few yards to his right. He whirled and fired at it. A moment later, the underbrush began to shake as if a huge snake were wriggling through it. Augustus ran into the weeds and saw the wounded Indian trying to crawl away. He at once shot him in the back of the head and didn't stop to turn him over. Backing out of the weeds, he stepped on the pistol that had misfired. An old cap-and-ball gun. He stuck it in his belt and hurried back to P., who looked white. He had sense enough to realize he had just almost been shot. Augustus glanced at the other dead Indian, a fat boy of maybe 17. His rifle was an old Sharp's carbine, which Augustus threw to P.
"We got to move," he said. "This cover's working against us. But for luck, we'd both be dead now already. What we need is a stretch with a steep bank and no cover."
They worked their way upstream, carrying the saddle, saddlebags, and guns, for nearly a mile, hugging the bank. Augustus was limping badly, but didn't stop to worry about it. Finally, they came to a bend in the creek, where the bank was sheer and about 10 feet high. The creek bottom was nearly bare of foliage.
"Let's dig," Augustus said,
and began to work with his knife to create a shallow cave under the bank. They worked furiously for half an hour until both were drenched with sweat and covered with dirt. Augustus used the stock of the Indian boy's carbine as a rude shovel and tried to shape the dirt they raked out into low breastworks on either side of the cave. They watched as best they could, but saw no Indians.
"Maybe they gave up," P.I. said. "You killed 5 so far."
5 reasons why they won't give up. They'll fight for their dead, since they expect to meet them again. Ain't you learned that by now?"
P.I. could not be sure that he had learned anything about Indians except that he was scared of them, and he had learned that long before he ever saw one. The digging was hard work, but they didn't dare stop. The Indians might show up at any time.
"Which Indians is these worth fighting?" he asked.
"They didn't introduce themselves, P. It might be written on these arrows. I'm going to be one-legged if we don't get this other arrow out pretty soon."
No sooner had he said it than it began to rain arrows, all arcing over the south bank of the creek.
"Crawl in," Augustus said.
He and P. scrunched back into the cave and stacked the saddlebags in front of them. Many of the arrows went over the creek bed entirely and into the prairie on the other side. A few stuck in the earthworks that they had thrown up, and 1 or 2 fell in the water.
"They're just hoping to get lucky," Augustus said. "If my darn leg was better, I'd sneak over to the other side of the creek and whittle down the odds a little more."
The shower of arrows soon stopped, but the two men stayed in the cave, taking no chances.
"I've got to push this arrow on through," Augustus said. "I may pass out, and if I do, I better do it now. When it gets dark, we'll both need to be watching."
He stopped talking and listened. He put his finger to his lips so P.I. would be quiet. Someone was on the bank above them, at least 1 Indian, maybe more. He motioned to P. to have his pistol ready, in case the Indians tried to rush them. Augustus was hoping for a rush, confident that with the 2 of them shooting, they could decimate the Indians to such an extent that the survivors might leave. If the Indians couldn't be discouraged and driven off, then the situation was serious. They had no horses. The herd was more than 100 miles away, and he was crippled. They could follow the creek down to the Yellowstone and perhaps strike Miles City, but it would be a slow trip for him to make crippled. Given his choices of gambles, he would prefer a fight. They might even be able to catch one of the Indians' horses. But the rush never came. Whoever was above them left. The creek bank on their side was already in shadow. Augustus uncocked his pistol, stretched his leg out again. He knew better than to put off anything to do with wounds, so he grasped the arrow and began to push it on through his leg. The pain was severe and caused a cold sweat to break out, but at least the arrow moved.
"My Lord, Gus, you're shot, too," P.I. said. When Augustus bent over to twist the arrow, P noticed that the back of his shirt, down low near his belt, was caked with blood. The dirt from their diggings had covered it, but there was no doubt that it was blood.
"One wound at a time," Augustus said.
It took both hands to move the arrow. The skin on his leg began to bulge.
"Cut,"
he said to P.
"Pretend I'm snake bit."
P went white. He hated even looking at wounds. The thought of cutting Gus made him want to be sick, but the fact that he had a sharp knife helped. He barely touched the skin, and the cut was made. The bloody tip of the arrow poked through. Gus shoved the tip on out and then fainted. P.I. had to pull the arrow on through. It was as hard as pulling a bolt out of a board, but he got it out. Then he felt deeply frightened. If the Indians came now, they were lost, he felt sure. He cocked his pistol and Gus's and held them both at the ready until his hands grew tired. His head was throbbing. He laid the guns down and wet Gus's forehead from the water bag, hoping Gus would revive. If the Indians came, he would have to shoot quick, and his best shooting had always been done slowly. He liked to take a fine aim. It seemed Gus would never revive. P.I. thought he might be dying, although he could hear him breathing. Finally, Gus opened his eyes. His breathing was ragged, but he reached over and took his pistol back as if he had just awakened from a refreshing nap. Then, to P.I.'s amazement, he crawled out of the cave, hobbled down to the water's edge, and dug in the mud with his knife. He came back with a handful of mud the size of a cannonball.
"Montana mud," he said. "I ain't happy about this wound. Maybe this mud'll cool it off."
He covered his wound with mud and offered P some.
"It's free mud," he said. "Take some."
Then he felt behind him, trying to judge the wound in his back that P had drawn attention to.
"It wasn't a bullet," he concluded. "I could feel a bullet. It's probably another arrow. It jiggled out during that run."
The twilight was deepening, the creek bed in shadow, though the upper sky was still light.
"I'll watch west, and you watch east," Augustus said.
Almost as soon as he finished speaking, a shot hit the cave bank just above their heads, causing dirt to shower down. Augustus looked down the creek and saw two horsemen cross it, too far away to make accurate targets in the dusk.
"I guess we're fairly surrounded," he said. "Some downstream and some upstream."
"I don't see why we didn't stay in Texas," P.I. said. "The Indians was mostly whipped down there."
"Well, this is just bad luck we're having," Augustus said. "We just run into a little bunch of fighters. I imagine they're about as scarce as the buffalo."
"Reckon we can hold them off till the captain comes and looks for us?" P asked.
"Yes, if I don't get sick from this leg," Augustus said. "This leg don't feel right. If it don't heal, you may have to go for help."
The thought frightened P.I. badly. Go for help, when Gus had just said that they were surrounded? Go and be scalped was what that was an invitation to.
"I expect they'd catch me if I tried that. Maybe the captain will figure out that we're in trouble and hurry on up here."
"He won't miss us for another week," Augustus said. "I don't fancy squatting here by this creek for a week."
A few minutes later, they heard a loud, strange cry from the east. It was an Indian war cry. Another came from the west, and several from the far bank of the river. The evening would be still and peaceful for a few minutes, and then the war cries would start again. P had never approved of the way Indians yelled when they fought. It upset his nerves. This yelling was no exception. Some of the cries were so piercing that he wanted to hold his ears. Augustus, however, listened with appreciation. The war cries continued for an hour. In a lull, Augustus cupped his hands and let out a long, loud cry himself. He kept it up until he ran out of breath. P.I. had never heard Augustus yell like that and hardly knew what to make of it. It sounded exactly like a Comanche war cry. The Indians surrounding them apparently didn't know what to make of it either. When Gus stopped yelling, they did too.
"I was just thanking them for the concert," Augustus said. Remember that old Comanche that went blind and used to hang around the fort? He taught me that. I doubt they've ever heard Comanche up in these parts. It might spook 'em a little.
Reckon they'll sneak up in the dark? P asked. That was his lifelong worry, being snuck up on in the dark by an Indian.
I doubt it. The eyesight of your average Indian is overrated. They spend too much time in them smoky teepees. The bulk of them can't see in the dark no better than we can, if as well. So it's a big chance for them sneaking up on sharpshooters like us.
Well, I ain't a sharpshooter, P.I. said. I need to take good aim or else I miss.
You're as near depressing as Jasper Fant, Augusta said.
No Indians came in the night, and Augustus was glad of that. He began to feel feverish and was afraid of taking a chill. He had to cover himself with saddle blankets, though he kept his gun hand free and managed to stay awake most of the night, unlike P, who snored beside him, as deeply asleep as if he were in a feather bed. By morning, Augustus had high fever. Though his leg worried him most, he also had a pain in his side. He decided he had been wrong in his first analysis, and that he did have a bullet wound there, after all. The fever had him feeling weak. While he was waiting, pistol cocked, to see if the Indians would try and rush them, he heard thunder. Within half an hour, lightning was striking all around them, the thunder crashing.
"Oh, dern," P.I. said. "Now I guess we'll get lightning struck." "Go back to sleep, if all you can do is be pessimistic. I smell rain, which is a blessing. Indians mostly don't like to fight in the wet. Only white men are dumb enough just to keep fighting no matter what the weather's like."
"We've fought Indians in the wet," P.I. said.
"Yes, but it was us that forced it on them," Augusta said. "They'd rather do battle on sunny days, which is only sensible. Here they're probably going to kill us, and you take up for them," P.I. said.
He had never understood Gus, and never would, even if the Indians didn't kill him.
"I am an admirer of good sense wherever I find it," Augustus said.
"I hope you find some today, then. Get us out of this," P said.
It began to rain in earnest. It rained so hard that it became impossible to see or even talk. A muddy stream began to pour off the bank, only inches in front of them. The rain struck so hard it reminded P of driving nails. Usually such freshets were short-lived, but this one wasn't. It seemed to rain for hours and was still raining when dawn came, though not as hard. Alarmingly to P, the creek had become a river, more than deep enough to swim a horse. It rose so that it was only 2 or 3 yards in from where they were scrunched into the cave, and it soon washed away their crude breastworks. And it was still raining. It was cold, too, though fortunately they had a good overhang and were fairly dry. Gus had drugged the bedrolls in before the rain started. P was shocked to see that Gus didn't look himself. His face was drawn and his hands unsteady. He was chewing on some jerky he had pulled out of a saddlebag, but it seemed he barely had the strength to eat.
"Are you poorly?" P asked.
"I should have got that arrow out sooner," Augustus said. "This leg's going to give me problems."
He handed P some jerky, and they sat in silence for a while, watching the brown flood sweep past them.
"Hell, a frog could have waded this creek yesterday," P said. "Now look at it. It's still raining, too. We may get drowned instead of scalped. It's a good thing Jasper ain't here," he added. "He's mighty afraid of water."
"Actually, this flood's an opportunity for you," Augusta said. "If we can last the day, you might swim past them tonight and get away."
"Well, but that wouldn't be right," P.I. said. "I wouldn't want to just leave you sitting here."
"I won't be sitting. I'll be floating if this keeps up. The good aspect of it is that it might cool off these Indians. They might go back to their families and let us be."
"I'd still hate to leave you,"
Even so, P said.
You can't carry me to the herd, and I doubt I can walk it. I'm running such a fever I'm apt to go out of my head any time. You probably have to trot back and bring some of the boys. Maybe the wagon. Then I can ride back in style.
The thought struck P.I. for the first time that Gus might die. He had no color, and he was shaking. It had never been suggested that Gus might die. Of course, he knew any man could die. P. himself had seen many die, yet it was a condition he had never associated with Gus McCrae, or with the captain either. They were not normal men, as he understood normal, and he had never reckoned with the possibility that either of them might die. Now, when he looked at Gus and saw his pallor and his shakes, the thought came into his mind and wouldn't leave. Gus might die. P knew at once he had to do everything possible to prevent it. If he went back to the wagon and reported that Gus was dead, there was no telling what the captain would say. Yet he didn't know exactly what he could do. They had no medicine. It was raining fits. The Indians had them surrounded, and they were 100 miles or more from the Hat Creek outfit.
It's a soggy situation, I admit, Augusta said,
as if reading P.I.'s thoughts.
But it ain't fatal yet. I could hold out here for a few days. Carl could make it back to this creek in one ride on that feisty mare of his. Best thing for you to do would be just travel at night. If you walk around in the daytime, some of these red boys might spot you, and you'd have about the chance of a rabbit. I guess you could make it to the Yellowstone in 3 nights, though. They ought to be there by then.
P.I. dreaded the prospect. He hated night travel, and it would be worse afoot. He began to hope that maybe the rain had discouraged the Indians, but that hope only lasted an hour. 3 times during the day the Indians fired on them. They shot from downriver, and Gus opened up on them at once. They were so respectful of his gun that their bullets only splattered uselessly in the mud, or else hit the water and ricocheted off with a whine. Gus looked so weak and shaky that P.I. wondered if he could still shoot accurately, but the question was answered later in the day when an Indian tried to shoot them from the opposite bank, using a little rain squall as cover. He got off his shot, which hit one of the saddles. Then Gus shot him as he turned to crawl away. The shot caused the Indian to straighten up, and Gus shot him again. The second bullet seemed to suck the Indian backward. He toppled off the bank and rolled into the water. He was not dead. He tried to swim, so Gus shot him again. A minute or two later, he floated past them face down.
I expect he would have drowned, P.I. said,
thinking it wasteful of Gus to shoot the man 3 times.
He might have, or he might have lived to cut off your nuts.
There were no more attacks that day, but there was no doubt that the Indians were still there. Before sundown, they raised their war cries again. This time, Augustus didn't answer. The day had never been bright, but it seemed to linger. There was a long, rainy dusk, so long that it made P.I. feel gloomy. It was cramped in the cave. He longed to stretch his legs, and then made the foolish mistake of saying so to Gus.
Wait until it's full dark, Augustus said. Then you can stretch him.
What if I get lost? P.I. said. I ain't never been in this country.
Go south, Augustus said. That's all you have to remember. If you mess up and go north, a polar bear will eat you.
Yes, and a grizzly bear might if I go south, P.I. said with some bitterness.
Either way, I'd be dead.
He regretted that Gus had mentioned bears. Bears had been preying on his mind since the Texas Bull had had his great fight. It struck him that things were tough up here in the north. It had taken Gus 3 shots to kill a small Indian. How many shots would it take to kill a grizzly bear?
Well, you ought to start, P,
Augusta said finally. It had been dark for over an hour, and the Indians were silent.
That darn water looks cold, P.I. said. I was never one for cold baths.
Well, I'm sorry we didn't bring a bathtub, a cook stove, Augusta said. If we had, we could heat some water for you. But as it is, you'll just have to rough it. The rain stopped. The creek could start going down any time, and the more water in it, the better for you. Get out in the middle and pretend you're a muskrat.
P.I. was half a mind not to go. He had never disobeyed an order in his life, but this time he was sorely tempted. And it was not just the cold swim or the chancy trek that made him hesitate. It was leaving Gus. Gus was so close to being out of his head. If he went on out of his head, the Indians would have a good chance to get him. He sat for a while, trying to think of some argument that would make Gus let him stay with him.
Maybe we could both swim out, he said. I know you're crippled, but you could lean on me once we started walking.
Pete, go on, Augusta said. I ain't getting well, and I'm getting sicker. If you want to help, go get Captain Call. Have him lope up here with an extra horse and tote me over to Miles City.
P.I. got ready with a heavy heart. It all seemed wrong. And none of it would have happened if they'd just stayed in Texas.
Just take your rifle, Augusta said. A pistol won't do you no good if you got to stop one of them bears. Besides, I'll need both pistols. Any fighting that happens here will be close range work.
I can't swim holding a darn rifle, Gus, P.I. said.
Stick it through your belt and down your pant leg. You can float downstream, and you won't actually have to swim much.
P.I. took off his boots and his shirt and made a bundle of them. Then he did as Gus ordered and stuck the rifle through his belt. He stuffed some jerky in one boot for provisions. All he needed to do was leave, but it was hard.
Now go on, P., Augusta said. Go get the captain. Don't worry about me. Don't let the Indians catch you, whatever you do.
Gus reached out a hand, and P.I. realized he was offering a handshake. P.I. shook his hand, feeling terribly sad.
Gus, I never thought I'd be leaving you, he said.
Well, you are, though, Augusta said. Trod carefully.
It was then that the conviction struck P.I. that he would never see Gus alive again. Mainly, what they were into was just another Indian fight, and all of those had inconveniences. But Gus had never sustained a wound before that P could remember. The arrows and bullets that had missed him so many times finally found him. After the handshake, Gus treated him as if he were already gone. He didn't offer any messages or say another word. P.I. wanted to say something else, but couldn't think of what. Feeling very disconsolate, he waded into the cold water. It was far colder than he had supposed. His legs at once felt numb. He looked back once and could dimly see the cave, but not Gus. As soon as he reached swimming depth, he forgot Gus and everything else due to a fear of drowning. The icy water pushed him under at once. Floating wasn't as easy as Gus had made it seem. The rifle was a big problem. Stuck in his pant leg, it seemed to weigh like lead. Also, he had no experience in such fast water. Several times he got swept over to the side of the creek and almost got tangled in the underbrush that the rushing water covered. Worse than that, he almost immediately lost the little bundle of boots and pants, shirt, all his provisions, and part of his ammunition. He had reached down with one hand to try and move the rifle a little higher up on his leg, and the water sucked the bundle away and swept it far ahead of him. P.I. began to realize he was going to drown unless he did better than he was doing. The water pushed him under several times. He wanted badly to climb up the bank, but was by no means sure that he was past the Indians. Gus said go down at least a mile, and he wasn't sure he had gone that far. The water had a suck to it that he had constantly to fight against. To his horror, he felt it sucking his pants off. He had been so disconsolate when he walked into the river that he had not buckled his belt tightly. He had nothing much in the way of hips, and the water sucked his pants down past them. The rifle sight was gouging him in the leg. He grabbed the rifle, but then went under. The dragging pants with the rifle in one leg were drowning him.